So for this afternoon, the first sutta which I'm going to read out for you is again a favorite of mine. It's called the Bahiya Sutta. I believe that has been made available to each person. Good. One of the reasons why I chose this very short sutta is that many people misinterpret it. And there's lots and lots and lots of strong evidence for many other parts of the Sutta Pitaka about how to really understand this little sutta. I remember Venerable Ñāna Ponika had a great good fortune of meeting him once in Sri Lanka in a forest hermitage in Kandy. With Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. And Bhikkhu Bodhi, he kind of surprised me. He was a great scholar, but he was looking after his teacher, Venerable Ñāna Ponika, with such great loving kindness. I never seen that in such a brilliant monk like Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. But also, I really appreciated sort of the wisdom of this very old monk. Was soon to pass away, Venerable Ñāna Ponika, and the advice that he gave me personally. The advice that he gave me was, if ever you are reading these teachings of the Buddha called the suttas, you should never interpret one ambiguous teaching in light and just by itself. You shouldn't just interpret the whole of the Tipitaka in the light of one strange teaching. Instead, you should interpret any ambiguous teaching in the light of all the other teachings, the vast number of teachings which the Buddha gave in the Tipitaka or Dvipitaka, Sutta Pitaka, and especially there to understand something like the Bahiya teaching in the context. Everything else which was said in the Dhamma Vinaya. So I'll now begin with the Bahiya Sutta teaching and explanation. But please excuse me, because it is the teachings of the Buddha, I just always want to give them respect by just saying Namo Tassa three times before I even start the teaching. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. This is the teaching called Bahiya teaching, which we'll find in Niyodhana, the first section, the 10th sutta. Bahiya's teaching. Bahiya, you should train yourself thus. In the seen will be merely this what is seen. In the heard will be merely what is heard. In the sensed will be merely what is sensed. And in the cognized will be merely what is cognized. Practicing in this way, Bahiya, you will not be. Because of that, when you are not because of that, you will not be in that. And when you are not in that, then you will be neither here nor beyond nor in between the two. Just this is the end of suffering. And through this brief teaching, Bahiya was immediately enlightened. Now that's such a powerful little teaching, short and to the point, and was the cause of Bahiya's enlightenment. And this is a little explanation which I wrote out afterwards. Number one, Bahiya was not a monk. The sutta does not record him giving dana. Nor taking refuge in the Triple Gem, nor keeping any precepts. Moreover, the sutta has no mention at all of Bahiya ever meditating, let alone reaching a jhana. Yet after receiving a very brief teaching from the Buddha, Bahiya became fully enlightened, an arahat, within seconds. This episode is very well known in Buddhist circles because it seems to make enlightenment so easy. It appears that you don't need to renounce. You can be miserly and not give dana. No ceremonies such as that of taking refuge are required. Precepts are unnecessary, and even meditating can be avoided. What a relief for some. All you need is intelligence, and everybody thinks that they are intelligent. This makes Bahiya's teaching both attractive and notorious. Were you paying attention when you heard Bahiya's teaching? How many of you were now fully enlightened because of that? So let's go deeper into this. As usual, there is more to this story than is recorded in this one sutta. It is often the case that the sutta records only the highlights of a long episode, just like the wedding photos did not record the first meeting, the dating, and the proposal. So many suttas do not record all that occurred before the finale. So what is the full story of Bahiya? How can we put the finale, captured for posterity in the Udana, into its full context? Fortunately, the whole story is recorded in the Upadana, which records some of the past lives of the arahats and in the commentaries. Now let's see the full story. In his previous life, Bahiya was a monk under the Buddha Kassapa, the previous Buddha. Together with six other monks, he climbed a steep mountain, throwing away the ladder, and determined to remain on top of that rock until they became enlightened or died. The enlightenment or bust idea. One of the seven monks did actually become an arahat. Another became an anagami, the non-returner. The other five died on the mountain. Bahiya was one of the five. In Bahiya's final life, he was a sailor, successfully crossing the ocean seven times. On the eighth voyage, he was shipwrecked, but managed to survive by floating ashore on a plank of wood. Having lost all his clothes, he made temporary garments out of bark and went begging for food in the town of Suparika. The townspeople were impressed with his appearance and offered him food, respect, and even a costly set of clothes. When Bahiya refused the new clothes, the people esteemed him even more. Bahiya had gained a comfortable living and so did not return to sea. And the people regarded Bahiya as an arahat, and soon Bahiya thought he was an arahat too. That's for the trouble. If people regard you over much as enlightened or special, then people tend to regard themselves as that. At that point, a deva, a heavenly being, discerned the wrong thought of Bahiya and out of compassion reprimanded him. It's okay to reprimand each other because it helps. That deva was none other than his former fellow monks. one of the seven. He was the one who had become an Anagami. It is interesting to add, the remaining four fellow monks were also reborn at this time, and they all, like Bahia, eventually attained enlightenment. They were Pukusati, Subhia, Kumara Kassapa, and Dabba Malaputta, often called Dabba the Malian. And many of them were amazing beings. Even a Dabba Malaputta, Dabba the Malian, he became fully enlightened when he was seven. And he continued his monastic life by doing a service for fellow monks. Dabba Malaputta's service was to be the guest monk. And he was a guest monk in the many monasteries and caves around Rajagaha. And the people, the monks, apparently, at that time, deliberately arrived at the bamboo grove in Rajagaha, always late, after sundown. And the reason, this is from the Vinaya Pitaka, the Vinaya, the reason why they arrived late is because to be taken to one of the lodgings, which were free, that it was dark, and so they needed some sort of light to show the way. And Dabba Malaputta could light one of his fingers. It was his psychic powers. And so he used the light from his finger to show the way to these visiting monks. And even monks at that time were quite very keen to see Dabba Malaputta use the light from his finger to show the way. Then the Anagami Deva, former friend of Bahia, informed Bahia about a true Arahant, the Buddha, living at that time on the other side of India at Sarvati. Bahia immediately left Suparika, present-day Sopara, just north of Mumbai, and reached Sarvati, just 17 kilometers west of Balrampur, in only one night. Bahia met the Buddha while he was on alms round and asked for a teaching. The Buddha at first refused, for it was an inappropriate time. But on being asked a third time, the Buddha interrupted his alms gathering and gave the famous teaching presented above. But within seconds of hearing that Dhamma, Bahia was fully enlightened. A few minutes later, the Arahat Bahia was killed by a cow with calf. So Bahia's background was exceptional. He had been a monk under the previous Buddha, Kassapa. His powers of determination were so strong that he went to meditate on the mountain with the resolve to become enlightened or die. In this life, he could hear devas speak to him, and he could travel more than halfway across India, some 1,300 kilometers. Okay, this is Ajahn Brahm's translation, as the levitator flies, not the crow flies, in only one night. If you had such a background from your previous life and had such psychic powers already in this life, then perhaps you too would have been enlightened when you heard Bahia's teachings a few minutes ago. It is usually the case that one requires a very deep samadhi, stillness, especially the stillness called jhanas, to achieve such psychic powers. Certainly, Bahia would have had a predisposition for meditation, taking account of his previous life. And the psychic power, which they call the divine ear, that enabled him to hear the deva, and the other psychic power that enabled him to travel so fast, suggest that he was practicing the jhanas before he heard the deva. Perhaps this was another reason why he thought himself an arahat. But there is more evidence to suggest that, though it was not mentioned in the texts, Bhaiya had been practicing jhana. Few people are aware that the very same teaching that here I call Bhaiya's teaching was also given by the Buddha to the very old monk Mallukyaputta. And now I'm going to quote that teaching. Venerable Mallukyaputta approached the Buddha and said to him, "Venerable sir, it would be good if the Buddha would teach me the Dhamma in brief, so that having heard the Dhamma from the Buddha, I might dwell alone, secluded, diligent, ardent, and resolute." The Buddha replied, "Mallukyaputta, what should I say to the young monastics, an old monk like you, come to the last stage of life, ask me for an exhortation in brief?" "Although, venerable sir, I am old," said Mallukyaputta, "let the Buddha teach me the Dhamma in brief. Perhaps I may understand the meaning of the Buddha's statement." So the Buddha replied, "What do you think, Mallukyaputta? Do you have any desire, lust, or affection for objects of sight that you have not seen and never saw before, that you do not see and would not think might be seen?" "No, venerable sir." "Do you have any desire, lust, or affection for those sounds cognizable by the ear, those odors cognizable by the nose, those tastes cognizable by the tongue, or for those tactile objects cognizable by the body, for those mental phenomena cognizable by the mind that you have not cognized and never cognized before, that you do not cognize and would not think might be cognized?" "No, venerable sir." "Hear, Mallukyaputta. Regarded things seen, heard, sensed, and cognized by you. In the seen, there will be merely the seen. In the heard, there will be merely the heard. In the sensed, there will be merely the sensed. And in the cognized, there will be merely the cognized. When, Mallukyaputta, regarding things seen, heard, sensed, and cognized by you, in the seen, there will be merely the seen. And in the heard, there will be merely the heard. In the sensed, there will be merely the sensed. In the cognized, there will be merely the cognized. Then, Mallukyaputta, you will not be by that. When, Mallukyaputta, you will not be by that, then you will not be therein. When, Mallukyaputta, you are not therein, then you will be neither here nor beyond, nor in between the two. This is the end of suffering." That was Bhaiya's teaching, now given to Mallukyaputta. "I understand in detail, venerable sir, the meaning of what was stated by the Buddha in brief." And this actually gives the first explanation of Bhaiya's teaching, what it really means. "Having seen a form with mindfulness distorted, attending to the pleasing sign, one experiences it with infatuated mind and remains tightly holding to it, and many feelings flourish within, originating from the visible form, covetousness and annoyance as well, by which one's mind becomes disturbed. For one who accumulates suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be far away. Having heard a sound, smelt an odor, enjoyed a taste, felt a contact, known an object with mindfulness distorted, for one who accumulates suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be far away." But when mindfulness is without hindrances, and of course those hindrances, I mean the five hindrances, when one is not excited by lust for whatever is seen, one experiences it with a dispassion and does not remain holding it tightly. One fares mindfully in such a way that even as one sees and experiences a feeling, suffering is exhausted, not built up. For one dismantling suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be close by. When mindfulness is without hindrances, one hears a sound, smells an odor, enjoys a taste, feels a contact, knows an object. One is not excited by lust for these things. And eventually one diminishes suffering thus. And Nibbana is said to be close by. And the Buddha replies, Sadhu, Alokyaputta, it is good that you understand the meaning of what was stated by me in brief. Then, Venerable Malankyaputta, delighted and rejoiced in the Buddha's words, rose from his seat and after paying homage, keeping him on his right, departed. Later, dwelling alone, secluded, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the Venerable Malankyaputta, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, in this very life, entered and dwelt in that unsurpassed goal of the holy life. He directly knew, destroyed his birth. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more rebirth. And the Venerable Malankyaputta became one of the arahants. And that's in Samyutta Nikaya 35, the 95th sutta. That takes Bahya's teaching and expands it. But once we link Bahya's teaching to Malankyaputta, it leads to more understanding of what this sutta means. Malankyaputta also appears in sutta number 64 of the Majjhima Nikaya, which is the Mahamalankyaputta Sutta, one of my favorites. And there the Buddha begins by scolding Malankyaputta for his wrong view, then teaches the necessity of attaining at least one of the jhanas in order to know what the five lower fetters really are, and then relinquishing them. The five lower fetters are what stops one becoming an anagami. And you can't just become enlightened without abandoning those five lower fetters first. And also, if you have renounced the first three of those lower fetters, then you are a stream winner. And so these are very important parts of understanding what these stages of enlightenment are. Those first five of the 10, they are what stop you from becoming an Aryan, streaming once returning, non-returning. So let's see what it says here. He then teaches the necessity of attaining at least one of the jhanas in order to know what the five lower fetters really are, and then relinquish them. The Buddha said in front of Malankyaputta that it is impossible to achieve non-returning, let alone full enlightenment, without a jhana, just as much as it is impossible to reach the heartwood of a tree without first going through its bark and sapwood. Here's the sutta, or the important part of it. There is one path only, Ananda, one way to the abandoning of the five basic fetters. It is impossible that anyone can understand or abandon these five basic fetters without relying on that path. And that was one of the statements that really stopped me. It's impossible that anyone can understand what these fetters are, let alone abandon them without relying on this path, no more than it is possible to cut out the heartwood from a tree without cutting through its bark and sandalwood, its sapwood. What is that path? The four jhanas and the first three immaterial attainments, 64th Sutta and the Majjhima. So Venerable Mahalunkyaputta was first taught the necessity of jhana, and then later he was given Bahia's teaching. After hearing Bahia's teaching, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, Mahalunkyaputta soon became an arahant. It is therefore certain that Mahalunkyaputta achieved jhanas before Bahia's teaching could be effective, or else the Buddha would be blatantly inconsistent. It also adds weight to the inference that Bahia also had experience of jhana before he heard the same teaching. Otherwise, he would have reached the heartwood of the tree without going through its bark and sapwood. So what did Bahia and Venerable Mahalunkyaputta see in the Buddha's words that generated the arahat experience? What does it mean in the seen will be merely what is seen? What it means is to see without any distortion of the data, without adding or subtracting from it. As modern psychology knows, what comes to our attention as the seen has already been sifted and distorted by our desires and aversions. This process of distortion occurs prior to the event of cognition. It is impossible to see this process as it occurs. It is what you might call subconscious. You can only infer its occurrence. We discover that our preferences have embellished the data to present to our mind what we wanted to see. While hostility has denied any access to the mind for those features that we didn't want to see. What we see is rarely merely the seen. That which we see with bare attention is seldom the truth. It is not the way things are. It is only the way things seem. The Buddha explained that this is the five hindrances that distort perception and corrupt our thinking. He called the five hindrances the nutriments that feed delusion. That's Anguttara, the 10th section, 61st Sutta. The first hindrance, sensual desire, selects what we want to see, hear, sense, and cognize. It often embellishes the truth. It presents to our consciousness the product of wishful thinking. The second hindrance, ill will, is that negative impulse that blocks us seeing, hearing, sensing, or cognizing what we don't want to know. It blinds us to what is unpleasant and to what is contrary to our view. Psychology knows the second hindrance as the process of denial. The third hindrance is sloth and torpor. This does not distort what we see, hear, sense, or cognize. It buries it in a fog so that we are unable to discern clearly. The fourth hindrance is restlessness and remorse, which keeps our senses on the run so fast that we do not have sufficient time to see, hear, sense, or cognize fully. Sights do not have time to fully form on our retina before the back of the eye has another sight to deal with. Sounds are hardly registered when we are asked to listen to something else. The fourth hindrance of restlessness, and a special case of remorse, which is inner restlessness due to bad conduct, is like the over-demanding boss in your office who never gives you enough time to finish a project properly. And the fifth hindrance is doubt, which interrupts the gathering of data with premature questions. Before we have fully experienced the seen, heard, sensed, or cognized, doubt interferes with the process, like a cocky student interrupting the teacher with a question in the midst of the lecture. To now be able to appreciate that it is these five hindrances that distort perception, corrupt the thinking, and maintain a deluded view. It is well known amongst the serious students of Buddhism that the only way to suppress these five hindrances is through the practice of jhana. Remember, I said suppress them, not eliminate them yet. As it says in the Nalakapana Sutta, that's the 68th in the Majjhima Nikaya, in one who does not attain a jhana, the five hindrances plus discontent and weariness invade the mind and remain. Anything less than jhana is not powerful and lasting enough to suppress the five hindrances sufficiently. So even if you are practicing bare mindfulness, with the five hindrances still active at a subconscious level, you are not seeing things as they truly are. And you are seeing things as they seem, distorted by these five hindrances. Thus, in order to fulfill the Buddha's teachings, the Bahiya and Venerable Mahalunkya Putta, in order that in the seen will be merely what is seen, in the heard will be merely what is heard, in the sensed will be merely what is sensed, and the cognized will be merely what is cognized, the five hindrances have to be suppressed, and that means jhana. The final part of Bahiya's teaching. Bahiya, you should train yourself thus. In the seen will be merely what is seen. In the seen will be merely what is seen, In the cognized will be merely what is cognized. Practicing in this way, Bahiya, you will not be because of that. When you are not because of that, you will not be in that. When you are not in that, you will be neither here nor beyond, nor in between the two. Just this is the end of suffering. What does it mean? You will not be because of that. And there are a few people here understand basic Pali. The Pali term for because of that is natthena. Tena is the instrumental word for that. Not as a negative. It means literally not because of that, not through that, not by that. It means in essence, you will not assume that there is a self, a soul, a me, because of, through, or by the seen or the heard or sensed or the cognized. This is not the cause of a misunderstanding about who you are. The Buddha is saying that once you have penetrated the truth of sensory experience by suppressing the hindrances through the jhanas, you will see that there is no doer nor a knower behind sensory experience. No longer will you be able to use sensory experience as evidence for yourself. You will not be because of that. Descartes' famous, I am because I think, is refuted. You will not be because of thinking, nor because of seeing, hearing, or sensing. In the Buddha's words, you will not be because of that, any sensory experience. When the sensory processes are discarded as tenable evidence for a self, a soul, or a me, then you are no longer located in the sensory experience. In the Buddha's words, you will not be in that. You will no longer view, perceive, or even think that there is a me involved in life. Please, this is showing how old I am and how long ago I wrote this. In the words of the Doctor in the original series of Star Trek, it is life, Jim, but not as we know it. I don't know if any of you remember that. There's no longer any sense of self. or saw at the center of experience. You are no more in that. Just to close off the loophole that you might think you can escape non-existence of a self or a soul by identifying with a transcendental state of being beyond what is seen, heard, sensed, or cognized. The Buddha thunders, and you will be neither here with the seen, heard, sensed, cognized, nor beyond, outside of the seen, heard, sensed, or cognized, nor in between the two, neither of the world nor beyond the world. The last phrase comprehensively confounded the sophists. In summary, the Buddha advised both Bahia and Venerable to experience the jhanas, to suppress the five hindrances. Thereby, one will discern with certainty the absence of a self or a soul behind the sensory process. Consequently, sensory experience will never again be taken as evidence of a knower or a doer. Such you will never imagine a self or a soul as a center of experience, nor beyond, nor anywhere else. Bahia's teaching put in a nutshell the way to the realization of no self, anatta. Just this, concluded the Buddha, is the end of suffering. Enlightenment requires all of the Noble Eightfold Path. It requires faith in the Triple Gem, the keeping of precepts and the practice of Dharma. There is only one path to Nibbana, and that is the Noble Eightfold Path. There are no shortcuts. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So that is the Bahia Sutta, not just stated, not just my view, but with many other supporting suttas, which I hope you found very useful. And hopefully that you have received the printed copy, which I basically read out 100%. This is what the Bahia Sutta means. And you add the other suttas which support, make it clear what that sutta really means. And when you do that, you see that to interpret, understand any such sutta, you do need all the other related suttas so that it gives a real meaning how a simple sailor, shipwrecked sailor, could actually manage to survive on the west coast of India and travel to see the Buddha just in one night and then become fully enlightened so quickly. That was the end, the finale of his life. So I hope you enjoyed that. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Ajahn, can I ask a question because we have a few more minutes?
Yes,
and other people get to ask this evening. I'm curious as to why your translation of Vinaya, which is close to Vinaya, which means the training and restraint, why you've translated that as suppress rather than restrain.
Yes, it is Vinaya, suppress, weaken, lessen its power and its intensity. And you will recognize that word in another context, the Pali word. That was such a wonderful thing to be able to learn Pali and then read these suttas in Pali, because you see the word used in another place. And that other place where it's used, where I think many of you should recognize if you listened to me before, in the Satipatthana, the things you do before you practice the Satipatthana, the prerequisites. That's Vinaya, Loke Abhijja Dhammanasa. Vinaya means to lessen the power of Loke Abhijja and Dhammanasa, which is translated meaninglessly in my words, in my ideas, my views, my understandings, translated meaninglessly as grief and covetousness for the world. You actually have to lessen them, lessen their power, suppress them. And that is what the previous the six factors of the Eightfold Path are supposed to do. Because of restraint, the powers of those hindrances are lessened, suppressed, weakened. They're not eradicated yet, but they are certainly less strong than they were before. That's why I use the word vinaya. Vinaya is like a training. It is related to the vinaya. And that's why sometimes the word vinati, the verb, which means to lessen, vinaya means having lessened already.
So, but to suppress is different from to restrain, isn't it?
Or suppressed or weakened, whatever it is. Because once it's suppressed, not through force, but like weakened, so they're less powerful, whatever word you wish to choose. Once they're suppressed, then you can actually see the Dhamma. Those hindrances are not strong anymore. And I'm not sure whether that suppressed word was my translation or just another word to give a rough meaning of what's happening here. I did make a very strong point. The five hindrances haven't been abandoned yet. They've been lessened so much, they're so weak. You might say weakened if you wish. And if they're weakened enough, that gives you enough power in your mindfulness to see things reasonably clearly. Does that answer the question?
Sort of, but I think restraint to me involves more wisdom.
Oh, yeah.
Like restraint to me is knowing what is beneficial, what's unbeneficial, what's wholesome, what's not wholesome, and actually moving away from one thing and maybe looking at something in a different way as well to kind of lessen. So it's a way to lessen, whereas suppress to me doesn't really involve any wisdom. It sounds like just pushing something away or pushing something down.
It's certainly not pushing down, not using willpower. Always suppress the wisdom power.
Mm.
In other words, the path to weaken those five hindrances. To weaken those five hindrances is never through willpower, because the willpower makes, if you're successful in lessening those five hindrances' power, if you're successful when you're doing it through willpower, that emphasizes or encourages you to believe in the power of the will, and which means those five hindrances even get stronger. But if you use the wisdom power, you understand, again, the benefits of lessening those hindrances, such as the first one, sensory desire, that you get much more happiness and peace and stillness through abandoning sensory desire. What was the Buddha saying, the similes with the bodies of water, and the first body of water? It's water with beautiful colors in it. Ill will, boiling water, bubbling. And those sorts of hindrances which show that they're not something to be developed, they have many dangers in them. And so that's why you abandon them with wisdom. There's not any point holding on to them. So not suppressing through force. Totally agree with that. Not suppressing through willpower. Not striving, but letting go. Putting down, abandoning, being freed, seeing they're not worth it.
Since we have a few more minutes, can I ask one more question?
Yes, yeah, certainly.
I'm just trying to give more time to you all as well. So there was something where you said, I think, that I'm not sure if it was in the Mahamalunkiputta Sutta, that one jhana is needed to know what the five lower fetters are and then to relinquish them.
Yeah.
And then you said something about the four jhanas are needed plus the first three arupas for what? Anagami? And I was curious, why three arupas? Why not the fourth?
That is the reason the fourth arupa is neither perception nor non-perception. That is such a refined state. It is so refined.
Yes.
It's not basically strong enough, clear enough, be able to be used as a experience which tells you, you know, that what that you don't exist, basically. Your sense of self is not there. It's way too refined. And if you want to have my explanation of what those immaterial attainments are, I call them attainments, immaterial states. These aren't attainments, these are just disappearances. I didn't make a point in the last talk I gave at the Quakers Center yesterday evening that this is all about the mind becoming still. Five senses have vanished in the jhanas, and then you go to deeper and deeper states of stillness. Some people wonder, well, if you don't do anything, you're not going to get anywhere. That is wrong. This is where you experience the mind being still, and then it goes deeper. When things are still, they disappear. It's like outermost states disappear. First, your five senses disappear, and then your will disappears. Much of this, what you take to be a joy and happiness disappears, and you get to the equanimity, the peace, the stillness of the fourth jhana, which is very pleasant still, but not in a coarse way. Then what happens? Are you just sitting there for eons, just being still? If you die and go into one of those states, you may do. But if you are still, your body is still warm and alive, then you won't be able to perceive your body, but your mind becomes so still that other things start disappearing. Stillness, it's strange to say this, stillness changes. It gets more still as more things vanish. And those first things which vanish, you know, the infinity of like space, the material world. It's not you go into a state of infinity, it's boundless, and it stops, disappears. To be able to be known, felt even, you need boundaries to it. When those things disappear, it does vanish. And then you go to the second immaterial state, boundlessness, no edges to consciousness. And then that's the mind consciousness now, that vanishes. That's weird when I start to say that even your knowing vanishes in the second immaterial as you go into the third. What the heck is going on if your consciousness vanishes? How can you ever know that? But then you see what is the Buddha describes as the third immaterial state, which is nothingness, nothing there. You see that things are vanishing more and more. You can know nothing. And then that vanishes, and then it's neither perception or non-perception. And how I explain that is when what you're looking at, perception has vanished. Be able to perceive that, which is kind of weird. Many states are weird until you have experience of them. Your mind, your knower, your sense of consciousness is vanishing, fading away, disappearing. And that state is so refined that the Buddha deemed it not possible to use that for the state of understanding the nature of things. Then, of course, everything vanishes. Nirodha Samapatti. Okay. If these things are attainments.
This is on the first day.
I love this. No, it's the idea of things disappearing, vanishing, going, not attaining. But you're just not there anymore. This is Bahia. It's a great sutta. And he vanished. It's only because he was a great monk before and his great friends who all became enlightened. So if you don't become enlightened in this life, don't worry. You have many friends. Mm-hmm. And they come and remind you if you're meditating correctly or not.
That's one good reason to have spiritual friends.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So, have I done it too short? Or?
No, it's wonderful. I think it's probably a lot for people to take in. So, thank you very much, Ajahn. It's a privilege to hear you teach your own ingenious and profound insights into these suttas and have them all sort of related to one another, because I think it takes a lot of study and also experience to really see how this fits together. So I guess that's a kind of teaching on right view and, how this whole path works.
Yeah.
So I hope everyone enjoyed that. Don't worry if it seems a bit too deep. It doesn't matter. The bits that are important stick with you and the other bits are saved for later, somewhere in the subconscious part of the mind. So, it's actually time to relax a bit now, to carry on with your own practice if you wish, or however you wish, because we're always practicing somehow. We don't have to be sitting cross-legged to practice. And then we'll meet again on Zoom at about 6:30.